Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode des Begründet Glauben Podcasts. Wir glauben, dass Glaube unserem Leben Sinn gibt und dass Glaube auch rational Sinn ergibt. Mein Name ist Alexander Fink, ich leite das Institut für Glaube und Wissenschaft und wir freuen uns auch immer über finanzielle Unterstützung unter iguw.de unterstützen.
To begin, could you introduce yourself, please? Who are you and what has shaped your life journey?
My name is Ellis Potter and I grew up in California and now I live in Basel, Switzerland. I was a Zen Buddhist monk for some years in California and then I became a Christian in Switzerland and worked in an evangelical study residential community called Lubri Fellowship that was founded by Francis Schaeffer. And then I came to Basel to be a pastor of an English-speaking international church. And now I pastor a church in Lausanne, and I commute to there. And I've done a lot of traveling for teaching and preaching in churches and universities and on every continent in the world. I've written 6 books and try to stay busy, and but I'm retired. And you can call me Pastor Potter.
How would you personally define suffering?
Suffering is any form of discomfort. And it usually includes the idea that something is wrong, that something is not the way it should be. It can be physical pain. It can be psychological pain of anxiety or fear or claustrophobia. It can be social pain of rejection and isolation. It can be a fear of death and unbecoming. It can be an identity crisis. It can be a debilitating disease. It can be being caught in an economic crisis or a war or a flood or something like that. But generally, suffering is something that people think should not be, that it's not normal or right or acceptable.
From your perspective as a former Buddhist monk, why does suffering exist and what are its root causes?
In Buddhism, there are 4 noble truths that we might call 4 spiritual laws. And the first one is the noble truth of suffering. And that states that everyone and everything suffers. And the Bible would agree with that. So there would be a correspondence with Buddhism and Christianity. The second noble truth says the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering in Buddhism is desire. If you desire something, you suffer because you don't have it and you want it, or you have it and you want to keep it. And nothing is certain in the space-time world. We cannot predict or ensure that everything will be exactly the way we want. And that uncertainty produces suffering.
How does Buddhism teach people to deal with suffering?
A Buddhist deals with suffering in a rather passive way, not trying to solve it, trying to simply be in it. And in fact, because Buddhism is a monistic approach and understanding of reality, meaning that basically everything is one, not 2 or 3, like some other worldviews believe, but everything is one, then you live in the one, in the unity, and you don't struggle to cause change. And you don't struggle to realize your desires. So the approach would be rather passive to suffering.
What sources of hope does Buddhism offer in the face of pain and hardship?
What reasons for hope do Buddhists have in the face of suffering? Buddhists believe in reincarnation. And so their hope is a very long-term hope. Millions and billions of years that cannot actually be measured. And so the hope is for enlightenment, for waking up out of the nightmare, the illusion of diversity, into the true reality of total unity, in which I am you and I am the stars and the Milky Way, and there is no desire because I am everything. All is one. And so the hope is for enlightenment. But of course, because suffering is caused by desire, you must stop hoping in order to arrive at the stopping of suffering, because hope is a desire and it produces suffering.
If everything is one and we are part of this oneness, where does the sense of separation come from?
The desire developed from a disturbance of reality. The Hindus would say a disturbance in the mind of Brahman. The Buddhists, especially the Zen Buddhists, would say desire is the play of two cosmic monkeys, which means we cannot understand it in a logical or historical way, but it has clearly happened that desire exists and illusion exists, and the suffering because of the illusion of diversity exists, and the source of it is beyond logic.
What causes the disturbance that pulls us away from this unity?
I don't think we can come to understand the source and the history of these things. We only know that they have happened because we experience them, and people have been experiencing them for thousands of years. And so they obviously have happened. And in a Buddhist understanding of reality, they are abnormal, because what is normal is the perfect beginning of total and complete unity.
What would a Buddhist typically say to someone in deep pain?
In Buddhism, suffering is not a reality. It is an illusion. Reality is perfect unity. And so we deal with an illusion by trying to wake up out of the nightmare of suffering and the illusion of diversity. If someone is suffering in a specific and extreme way from a painful disease or broken bone or a serious depression or something like that, a Buddhist would advise them to quiet their mind and not to think about it, and to meditate, which means to stop thinking and to allow the mind to function independently of the brain. Normally, in Buddhism, they didn't develop hospitals and medical treatment. Buddhism was often combined with Taoism and Confucianism in Asia, and there were therapeutic methodologies of diet and environment, feng shui, and things like that. But medicine as such and hospitalers were not developed in Buddhism because of the doctrine of ahimsa or non-interference. This means that if someone is on their journey of the transmigration of souls through many incarnations, they need to experience many kinds of situations in order to fully and totally be released from the illusion of diversity. So they need to be male and female and rich and poor and sick and healthy and beautiful and ugly and popular and hated. They need to experience all these different kinds of things. And if someone needs to experience the suffering of poverty and disease and begging in the gutter, and you help that person and change their situation, they will have to live that life all over again. And so by helping them, you force them to live through a reincarnation again, and you slow down their process. So it's really not a favor to change someone's circumstances, because they need to experience that.
Do you see similarities between Buddhism and Christianity?
All human beings are human beings, and there are similarities in the way human beings live and act and desire and the values that they have, all over the world and all through history. But specific similarities between Christianity and Buddhism, I'm not sure that we actually find them. The main difference between Buddhism and Hinduism and Christianity is that Buddhism is a monistic approach to reality, believing that the original perfection of reality is total unity. Almost everyone believes that reality began in a perfect condition and situation. Very few people believe in the beginning everything was a horrible chaos and it just continues that way. That would mean that nothing is wrong, that everything is normal. Most people believe that something is wrong. Most people complain and say, that should not be, that is wrong. Well, in order to know that, we have to know what is right. And in Buddhism, what is right is a total unity, and diversity is wrong. In Christianity, the original perfection is personal. Three persons in relationship with each other, with communication with each other, with mutual support and sacrifice and serving of each other. And what has gone wrong is that we have become self-centered and isolated and imploding. As an explosion goes out, we implode and we crush ourselves and we become like a black hole where no light can escape. This would be a description of death. So in Christianity, the beginning, the perfect beginning of reality is radically different from a Buddhist understanding of what is perfection. And so our understanding of what is wrong is going to be very different as well. There is unity, which means everything is one, and diversity. And in the biblical description of reality, you have both. God is one God and three persons. I've made up a proverb that expresses that. It's not in the Bible, but it's a very good proverb. And it says, God alone is God, and God is not alone. Only the Bible supports that statement.
Regarding Amitabha Buddhism, do you believe there has been an exchange of ideas between it and Christianity?
Yes, there is in Buddhism a variety of Buddhas who are people who have become enlightened, but they take what is called the vow or the promise of the bodhisattva, the enlightened person, and they don't enter total nirvana. They don't become one with everything for the sake of teaching others. And so they continue to reincarnate. And one of these people who became a Buddha is Amida or Amitabha. And this Buddha has the capacity to burn karma, to take what you have done that inhibits your unity and your release from the nightmare of diversity, and to burn it up so that you don't have to pay it yourself. This is clearly an idea of grace. And as far as I know, it's a later development in Buddhism, and possibly it developed in Buddhism because Christians traveled to Buddhist countries, and Buddhists heard these ideas, and they are very human ideas of grace because we all realize we cannot help ourselves, and the idea that someone will help us is very attractive to almost anyone. And so then these ideas of grace and mercy are in certain forms of Buddhism, and I think were later developments.
How does Buddhism respond to hostility or personal attacks?
An advanced Buddhist, if they're attacked, would recognize that it is the karma of the attacker to attack, and it is the karma of themselves to be attacked, and they would go with the flow. Most likely, they would not retaliate.
Is there a concept of forgiveness in Buddhism?
There is not a clear concept of forgiveness in Buddhism. There's the concept of enlightenment, and everyone has to work out their own enlightenment. But when we become enlightened, then we become each other. And so that's a unification, and you could call it forgiveness, but it's a restoration.
How does Buddhism connect suffering with enlightenment?
There is a lot of confusion about Buddha. Many people think Buddha is the fat guy laughing painted golden in the restaurant. This is one expression of Buddhism, but there are many artistic expressions, standing, sitting, lying down, fat, happy, sad, various artistic expressions of Buddha. In Zen Buddhism, there's perhaps the clearest and most radical understanding, and that is that Buddha is possibility. Possibility is real, and it is nothing. We can say it is possible that it will rain tonight, and that possibility is real, but it's not measurable. It's nothing. It's not a probability. It's a possibility. Everything that is possible. The earth is possible, or it wouldn't be here. Is God possible? Yes, God is possible. Is the devil possible? Yes, the devil is possible. Are you possible? Yes, you are possible. Sometimes your parents tell you you're impossible, but it's not true. You are possible, or you wouldn't exist. So possibility is the nothing that is pregnant with everything. Buddha is possibility. You realize a total possibility by becoming nothing. When you become absolutely nothing, then you become absolutely everything. And you realize possibility. When Siddhartha Gautama, Buddha in India, in Banaras, was enlightened, he sat under a tree for 40 days and 40 nights, and then he opened his eyes, and he knew he was enlightened because he saw the planet Venus, the morning star in the horizon, and he knew that he was looking at himself, because all is one. And he had realized possibility. So when you realize possibility, you dissolve as an individual entity in relationship with other individual entities, and you realize possibility. So you become everything in potential. So a Buddhist will meet you and say, good morning, I am you, or good morning, you are God. Just as a reminder, as an encouragement to you to keep in mind the truth. That everything is one. I think what a question I've seen is, does suffering have meaning, or what is the meaning of suffering? And in order to know what we're talking about, I think it's important to ask ourselves, what does meaning mean?
From a Christian perspective, what does meaning truly mean to you?
Meaning means relationships, which means that nothing has meaning in itself. I can give you an illustration. The meaning of the color red is not in the color red. In red, you just have red. There's no meaning. There's no relationship. The meaning in the color red is in its relationships with green and blue and yellow. So there is only meaning in relationships. So the idea of being self-actualizing or producing my own meaning is quite absurd, because meaning only exists in relationship. I don't have meaning in myself. This is a very popular idea, but it's a very destructive idea, and it's a very isolating and alienating idea, because I have to become my own God when I invent myself, my gender, or whatever else it is that I invent. I have my own meaning in myself. Then I become a black hole, and then I am dead. It is only in relationships that I have an active, dynamic existence. So the meaning of suffering is the relationships that there are in suffering. The meaning of anything is in the relationships. So if you have a beginning that is a perfect unity, there is no meaning. Meaning is a function of diversity. And so in Zen Buddhism, which is monistic. Meaning is evil. Meaning is the cause of suffering because it's relationship. And in relationships, you always have desire, and desire is the cause of suffering. In the biblical view of the original perfection, you have three persons who are not identical with each other. They're not clones of each other. The Son is not a copy of the Father. He has a different point of view, and so does the Spirit. And they relate to each other, and they communicate with each other. And so there is meaning in the original perfection of reality.
Have you personally experienced suffering in your life?
Yes, we all experience suffering, and I have experienced suffering of various kinds. Some are very personal. Others could be understood. I'm a depressive person, and I suffered a depression 15 years ago for which I was hospitalized for 5 weeks. And there was suffering. A nurse came to me one day and said, "Mr. Potter, what are you doing?" And I said, "I am being in pain." And how I worked with that was I asked myself, does God love me? Does he keep me? Am I safe in his truth and his power to keep my being valid? And the answer was always, oh, yeah, there's no problem. That's absolutely sure, as there's a foundation for my life. I might be dead tomorrow, but that's a minor point compared with the fact that I am safe in God's truth and he keeps me.
What has helped you most in coping with it?
There are various things that help. Prayer helps. Reading the Bible helps. Having friends, talking with people, being active, being creative, seeing beauty, doing things that you like, looking at flowers, different kinds of things can help. I think we need to try what we can try. We're all individuals and we all suffer in different ways. And sometimes the suffering that we have is physically or psychologically fatal. We die, but everybody dies. So far, everybody that has ever lived has died, except Enoch and maybe Elijah. And so coping doesn't mean that I escape death in the sense of prevent myself from dying socially or psychologically or physically. But the hope is that because God, in the person of Jesus Christ, has embraced all of suffering of all of time and has conquered death and risen from the grave in an eternal physical body that functions in the dimensions of space-time and the dimensions of supernatural eternity, because he has done this, that reality is available to us if we will accept that he will forgive us, restore us, and receive us into the life that he has died and risen to prepare for us. So there is great hope in that, even though our suffering kills us physically, our situation is not hopeless.
What would you say to a close friend who is suffering?
If I had a friend who suffered from an incurable disease, I would ask, "How are you?" I would listen. I would listen much louder than I talk.
What do people often do or say that is unhelpful when someone is in pain?
Oh, there are various unhelpful things. Most of the unhelpful things that I've been aware of are things done by Christians. For instance, I know that some Christians tell people, if you really had faith, you wouldn't be suffering like this. This is just about as unhelpful as you can possibly be. Or to say, just grin and bear it. Or to say, it'll be all right. Everything is fine. It comes out. Or it was meant to be. All sorts of nonsense kinds of things to say to someone are confusing and hurtful and not helpful at all.
How can suffering become a source of meaning rather than despair?
There is always meaning in suffering. Meaning doesn't have to be good or positive. Meaning can be evil. It is only the relationship. Meaning can be physical. I'm sick because I have a bacterial infection or I have a cancer in my body. The meaning of suffering can be I'm learning patience and I'm becoming more human and more tolerant of other people. So we can find negative meanings and positive meanings, but there's always an infinity of meaning in our suffering.
Why did you choose to become a Christian after being a Buddhist monk?
Yeah, I became a Christian after I was a Zen Buddhist monk for some time because I became convinced that it takes less faith to believe in Christianity than to believe in anything else. It takes less faith to be a Christian because the Bible answers more questions than other understandings and philosophies. It doesn't answer all of our questions, but the questions that it does answer, the answers turn out to be true and livable.
Many people argue that the Bible is full of myths and contradictions. What makes it trustworthy for you?
Well, the Bible is very realistic. It says that people are basically horrible. And this has been my experience of myself and the others that I have known. The Bible is not romantic. The Bible isn't even a religious book. Religion means to reconnect with perfection. And it assumes that we are separated. Religio, to re-ligament, like you connect the ligament in your arm. And religion is the practice of people trying to reconnect with a lost perfection, a god or an absolute of some kind. Christianity is the opposite of religion. It is God, the original perfection, connecting with us. And that was very attractive to me. But I used to be a very religious person, but now I am a Christian.
From a Christian point of view, is there hope that suffering has a deeper purpose?
So is there hope that there is a purpose in suffering? The Bible does give a hope. It says, all things work for good for those who love the Lord. That doesn't mean all things are good. It means all things work for good for those who love the Lord. So the question is not, why do I suffer? Or can I get relief or justice? The question is, do I love God by loving other people? And if I do love God and I do love other people, this suffering will work for good in my life, even though it kills me. So the question is, do I love God? I tell you a little story, the parable of the banana peel. I am a missionary. And I'm often going to catch the train to go to the airport. And if I get up late and I'm running on the train track to get to the train and I slip on a banana peel and break my ankle, then I'm lying there in pain and the train leaves. How can I understand why this is happening? Is it the result of my sin in getting up late and being lazy? Is it the result of the sin of the banana eater? Is it the devil trying to prevent me from going someplace where people will be blessed and helped? Is it God preventing me from getting on that train because it's going to crash 10 miles down the track? I don't know what the cause is. My job is not to figure it out. My job is to love God and to look for what good might come from that suffering. I learn patience. I learn discipline. I am a blessing to the nurses in the hospital where they take me. There are all kinds of good things that can happen if I love the Lord. If I love the Lord, I think it's a biblical promise that good will be realized and that I should expect it and look for it.
You said love the Lord, it's about loving others.
Yeah. So Jesus said the first commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then he said the second is like it, which means the second is the same thing. love your neighbor as yourself. They cannot be separated. Loving God and loving your neighbor cannot be separated. They are the same thing.
Thank you very much, Alice.
Hat Ihnen diese Folge des Begründet Glauben Podcasts wertvolle Impulse zum Weiterdenken geliefert? Dann empfehlen Sie uns gerne weiter und wir freuen uns immer über finanzielle Unterstützung unter iguw.de, Institut für Glaube und Wissenschaft. Vielen Dank!